is Gene King, and the name of this program is Conversation for Consumers. It's brought to you as a public service by the Council of Better Business Bureaus in cooperation with this station. And today, my guest is Senator John Chafee, who is a Republican from the glorious state of Rhode Island. It mightn't be large, but it's very important, little old Rhode Island. Senator Chafee has an enviable reputation in the Senate as being a very progressive, moderately liberal Republican. Is that a fair statement of your position, Senator?
Yes, that is a fair statement. Whether I have an eminent reputation, I'll have to leave that to others to judge. But I think you've got me slotted correctly, if you can, in the spectrum of where I tend to vote in the Senate, although everybody sort of dislikes being pegged this way or that way, but I think you've got me about the right place.
Well, I think these days you just can't be pegged any particular way, but I think your voting record shows that you're a liberal.
I suppose,
yes. Yeah,
okay. Let's call it moderate. That's a popular term these days.
Yeah, that's right. Liberals are out of fashion, aren't they?
That's right.
All right. I want to talk to you about a lot of things now that I have you. And incidentally, we're very happy and we're honored to have you on Conversation for Consumers. I think it was very nice of you to take the time to give us your views, and we're going to get as many of your views on as many subjects as we possibly can. I'd like to talk to you about energy to begin with and how it affects the ordinary person. I'd like to talk to you about, just to start, an oil tax. Now, what do you think? I know you've been introducing legislation in that direction, right?
Yes. Yes, what we've been doing, what I've been actively involved in, what the Congress has done, is to enact what they call a windfall profits tax. As you know, the price of oil in this country was controlled by the federal government with certain prices for different types of oil, old oil being oil that was discovered at a certain time, and newly discovered oil, of course, is oil that we're going to hopefully find in the future. Different prices were established for these different types of oil. Then the president, wisely in my judgment, decided we should decontrol the price of oil. Let it go to the world market. So whereas somebody was selling their, or could only obtain for their oil $9 a barrel under the regulations, suddenly they can now get $30 a barrel. So the president has come up with a term describing the difference between the 9 and the 30 to be a windfall. And then the question is, should the oil companies be able to keep that entirely, or should there be some kind of a tax on it, since the oil companies are going to get fairly rich when you go from, they're making money on $9 a barrel, so when they get 30, they're going to get really rich. And the difficulty in enacting a tax on all this is where to impose the tax where it'll yield some revenue yet won't be act as a disincentive. After all, we want these oil companies to go out and discover new oil. We want them to keep producing. We want them, if they've got an oil well, we don't want to put such a high tax on it that there'll be no incentive to, say, pump new material down into the ground to produce more oil. So anyway, that's called a windfall profits tax.
And you're in favor of it?
I am. I'm in favor of it's hard to say you're in favor of what one man describes as a windfall profit tax. He might tax all types of oil. I personally do not favor taxing newly discovered oil at all. I think if Mobil or whoever it is, Exxon or whoever, will go off the Atlantic coast into deep and turbulent waters and discover new oil, three cheers. Let them keep the profit. We need more oil.
You know, speaking of that, there was a tremendous flap, wasn't it, off the coast of Cape Cod when the St. George's Channel or whatever they call
George's
it.
George's Banks.
George's Banks.
Yes, great fishing area.
Yeah, great fishing area, and they knocked out the fishermen and they gave it to the oil companies.
Well, no, that's not quite accurate, Gene, to say they knocked out the fishermen. No, what they decided was that there's certain, they divided up into tracts, which is acreage, I suppose you could call it. And they decided that certain of these tracts should be available for exploratory purposes. And I believe, as does the Secretary of Interior, Mr. Andrus, who's in charge of all this, that the discovery of oil and the existence of the fishing grounds are compatible. I don't think they're incompatible. And there are all kinds of restrictions upon the type of drilling, severe fines if there's spillage. All kinds of precautionary efforts have to be taken. And I think that, first of all, I hope they discover oil. And secondly, I think the production of the oil and the fishing can coexist.
Well, now, you know, we're in the middle of inflation, Senator. And a lot of people say that the inflation, I think President Carter said that the other day, inflation is directly attributable to OPEC and the price of oil going up and up and up. Now, the president also said that he is not in favor of a tax break or of tax reduction in 1981. And all I see from my point of view is that the cost of living is going up and up and up. Social Security taxes are going up. And where does that leave the ordinary human being? Where does that leave the homeowner? Where does that leave the person who's trying to make a living for himself and his family?
Well, Gene, let's go back a little bit. The president very conveniently blames OPEC for inflation. That's a wonderful way of doing it. But the truth of the matter is that his fiscal policies have produced the inflation in this country. When Gerry Ford left office, inflation in the United States was 4%. President Carter and his policies have been in now for 3 years, exactly 3 years, and we've got 14% inflation. So what's better for the president than to blame some whipping boy such as OPEC for inflation in the United States? That doesn't sell, because OPEC is selling oil to the West Germans. The West Germans import 99% of their oil, and they don't have any inflation approaching ours. So I hope you won't bite for that one that the president conveniently used as an excuse for his maladministration, that inflation results from OPEC. Inflation results from his policies. And now you ask, what does the ordinary homeowner do about it? I suppose you were asking in connection with inflation.
Sure.
The ordinary homeowner is trapped in a terrible predicament, and the way we're going to end this inflation is to get a decent administration in there that'll face up to the problems. And first of all, realize that we've got to have a balanced budget. That's what caused inflation. And so this nice excuse, the president, I heard him the other day, I guess it was in Meet the Press, where he said, but inflation has come about due to OPEC. Baloney.
That's what I like. I like to have a completely non-political program.
Right. You know? Well, I mean, I don't think you'll find any economist that'll say that OPEC's blame for inflation.
All right. Now, let me ask you something else. You've recently returned from a trip to Israel and Jordan and Saudi Arabia. Now, was this a congressional junket, or did you go over there to find out something?
Well, it no way falls under the definition of a junket. If flying 12 hours tourist class, TWA, is a junket, then my definition, then the junketing is falling into hard times. I went over there with one aide, because we are expending, one, great sums of money in Israel. For example, the U.S. is spending over $2 billion a year in aid to Israel. I'd never been there before. I thought it was wise to see the country, get to know the terrain, talk firsthand with the people over there and understand the problems. Then, of course, in Jordan and Saudi Arabia, it's a crucial area geographically and from a supply point of view. Also, one of the reasons I went over there, I'm on the Finance Committee, as you might know, which deals with taxation. We've had rumors back that our tax policies on foreign Americans abroad have acted as a disincentive for Americans to work abroad, and the result has been great losses in not only the wages that the Americans earn abroad, but more importantly, with the goods, American goods that they sell there. And I came back from there very, very discouraged on our tax policies. It's a classic case of the U.S. shooting itself in the foot.
Why?
What we did in 1976, we decided that every American abroad would have to have all his income earned abroad count as regular income and be taxed at American rates. Now, no other industrial nation in the world has a system like that. If a Britisher goes abroad, he's not taxed on his earnings abroad. And so when you put this tax on, Americans who serve in Saudi Arabia, for example, and let me just say, serving in Saudi Arabia is tough territory.
It is no picnic.
It's no picnic, and particularly if your wife is with you. No woman can drive. Never mind Saudi Arabian woman, but no American woman is allowed to drive. They're not allowed to have jobs. Once upon a time, American women could, say, work as a secretary in the Aramco office or in Westinghouse's office over there. That's not permitted anymore. There's nothing to do. It's an absolutely barren landscape. There's very little of historical architecture around, nothing that you can kind of get into, sink your teeth into. And so it's a land that anyone...
It's really a hardship post.
It's a hardship post.
Right.
And so the American says, now what am I doing here? This is crazy. I could be back in Sunnyvale, California, or Vermont, or wherever it is. And if I'm going to be taxed just like I would at home, then there's no point in my being here. Now the loss, so therefore, now the company can say, oh well, we'll reimburse you extra, but then that's taxable.
So it's really double taxation.
So it doesn't work out in favor of the person. So if he stays, if he goes back home, the company says, well, we'll get somebody who will come out that can make some money at it. We'll get a Britisher.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the great failing in that is not just that America, we've lost one more job for an American, but the Britisher gets out there in a middle executive position, say in some construction firm, and not because he's evil or anything, but he has to order an elevator for the firm. He has to decide what kind of piping there'll be, what kind of electrical outlets and all that. He's used to British equipment, and he wants to get something he knows and can rely on, so he orders all British equipment. And so the U.S. loses out on the jobs that would be created by the orders the Americans would put in. It's an absolute disaster.
That's fascinating. You know, really, I'm awfully glad I asked that question, because I never knew that.
I didn't know it either, yeah. Sam, before I went there. And it shows that many tax policies that'll yield some revenue in the short run, in the long run, are disastrous.
Now, have you
for taxes for jobs?
Yeah, have you reported this back to the Senate?
Yes. Of course, we've just started, as you know.
Yeah,
but,
I know.
What I'm doing is working, and I might say I'm not the only one that's onto this. There's a Presidential Export Commission headed by Mr. Reg Jones, who's the head of General Electric,
yeah,
who's making a study of these things. And these disincentives, oh, there's a whole host of them. For example, a few years ago, we decided that it was very wicked for Americans to be bribing people abroad.
That was the Lockheed.
The Lockheed,
yeah, right,
scandal and all,
right,
that. So, in typical fashion, we enact extremely restrictive laws. And as you know, what we might in our righteous society here consider a bribe in the United States, in some foreign land is considered a way of doing business. It's everybody does it. It's
sort of bakshish.
Yes, in the Marine Corps we used to call it come shore.
Right.
When you're working in China, the old days they'd say the boats would come alongside the troop transports and they'd call up, come ashore, ride ashore, and so you'd pay something to get ashore. So we used to call it come ashore. Now it might be a commission, it might be a certain little percentage here and there. Any event, the Americans are forbidden to do anything like that. Of course, the foreigners are all doing it, and they're getting the orders. And
Listen, Senator, what are we going to do about our exports? What are we going to do about this business of our losing so much money in exporting all over the world?
Some of these things I've mentioned. Of course, in all fairness, many American companies aren't oriented toward exports. Germany exports 40% of its manufactured goods. In the U.S., we export 7%. So, when you're a manufacturer in Rhode Island, for example, what you first think of is the New York market, or Pennsylvania, or California, or Ohio, or Texas, these tremendous markets. And when somebody says, hey, there's a chance to sell some goods in Italy, you think, oh, brother, my worry list is full. I can't get tangled up with all that, and I don't know how to get around and what to do in Italy or Saudi Arabia, wherever it is. I'd much rather send my salesperson out to Detroit and hustle up an order. So Americans tend to concentrate on the American market. But nonetheless, when you take 7%, that's a whale of a lot of goods.
Sure.
Billions and billions of dollars of goods, and it all translates into jobs for Americans.
Now, what do you think of the Carter proposal for the grain boycott on the Soviet Union along this line?
Yeah, well, I agreed with him. I think it's right. That there, boy, it was tough. Although I must say, I was horrified to read that under certain contracts, we must supply the Soviets, and that we were for going ahead with those. And then the longshoremen announced they're not going to load, and what do? The president says, oh, we'll buy it up. Well, I just hate that, like heck, to think that Mr. Gleason of the International Longshoremen's Association is determining the foreign policy of the United States.
You know what George Meany said when the longshoremen pulled a strike when he was still alive and the head of the AFL-CIO?
No.
And someone said to him, who are you and your members to determine foreign policy? And he puffed on his cigar and he said, foreign policy is too important to be left to the Secretary of State.
Yeah, well, that's
that
may be so, but it's also too important to leave to Mr. Gleason also.
Yeah, right.
So I don't buy Mr. Meany's statement on that one.
All right, what do you think of the Olympic boycott then? Do you mind my asking you?
No, that's all right. No, that's all right. I've been brooding over that Olympic thing. I've been associated in a way with some of the runners and people who've been involved in the long training, and the two things I'd really like to know. One, I've never been to Russia. I don't consider myself a Russian expert or even a junior varsity expert on Russia. So I'd wonder how much of an effect would it have on them? And secondly, I'd hate like Dickens to think that the U.S., we'd end up the only one boycotting.
France has already said they won't.
Well, that's typical of
the
French.
Yeah,
they wouldn't cooperate. But I just wonder if any of the others, whether we've got any inkling that some of the big nations, well, take the West Germans or the British, or if you got the West Germans, the British, the Canadians, the Americans, the Australians, something like that, you'd be able to put a crimp in their style. But if the Americans alone pulled out, and everything else went ahead full throttle, I just wonder how much difference it would make.
Of course, the thing that concerns me also is, you know, all these are empty gestures, really. I mean, you know, you're a bad boy, and I'm not going to talk to you any longer. I am looking toward Congress and toward the President for some positive action, not these things like putting a Band-Aid on cancer. And this is what I think the country is looking for, too, whether it's Iran, whether it's the hostages, whether it's the Olympics or something else. Do you get this message from your constituents in Rhode Island, Senator?
I do. I do get the feeling that, you know, it's all right for the president to, in one instance, to do nothing, like in Iran. It's amazing, isn't it, that suddenly a president who was accused of lacking leadership suddenly is regarded as a great leader by dint of doing nothing. In Iran, and his whole policy is urging caution and restraint and do nothing. Whatever you do, don't do anything. But when Afghanistan happens, I think the people are saying, "Now, come on, we're hiring you down there, Mr. President, to have some options." And it isn't enough to say to the American people, "Well, what would you do?" If all of us had the solutions, we ought to be in the White House. But he's there. He's got the mechanisms. The staff, the options presented to him by a zillion people who are working on this, and it seems to me his only answer is, I don't have an answer. And I think the people are asking that something be done.
Something positive.
Something positive.
Well, what we're getting...
In other words, it's not enough for them to say, well, this is outrageous. I'm going up to New York and complain to the UN.
Yeah, that doesn't mean anything, right. Well, of course, what we are getting now is an arms buildup. And what I worry about is this. You know, even though we are a very rich nation, we only have so much money. And the more money you put into arms, the less money you're going to have for social programs. Isn't that true?
That's right.
And then what happens to our way of life? What happens... to the people who need social programs. And I'm not saying that bigger is better as far as the government is concerned. I'm just talking about what's going to happen to the, once again, the ordinary person.
Well, when you put your finger on it, when you get more arms, and obviously there's going to be a greater buildup in the military forces, something goes down. You know, Johnson tried to lead us down the rosy path of having guns and butter both, and that,
but you can't do it.
That was one of the seeds for the inflation that we're in now, and so something has to give, and obviously health and health programs and education programs and security income programs, a whole they're going to be remain stable, which in an inflationary time means you go backwards.
That's right, and this is affecting business, doesn't it?
Well, I don't think it's affecting business as much.
Don't you?
As it's affecting the poor guy who's on the bottom of the heap.
Yeah, but what's going to happen to the small businessman in this particular situation where he sells to the what we would call the ordinary consumer?
Well, I don't think he's going to be hurt particularly. Small businessmen have lots of problems, but I don't think this increase in the arms, spending more money on arms as opposed to social programs, is a problem to the small businessman.
But isn't he going to be taxed more and more?
Well, yes, he might. His taxes might be increased or might remain the same. Under the theory we had, where you're going to work out of a common pot and you increase the amount for defense, you cut down the amount for social programs, that doesn't call for a tax increase. But if you want to talk about small businessmen, they do have a lot of problems. As you know, they're complaining bitterly about the amount of federal paperwork that's put on them, the all kinds of requirements that a tremendous company can handle, but a little 3 or 4 person shop can't handle.
You know, one of the reasons that I'm so happy to have you on the program, Senator, is this. Let me give you the Gene King attitude toward this. You know, I have a feeling that we are a nation right now that is cynical. We don't trust labor. We don't trust the government. We don't even trust education. We feel that organized religion is anachronistic. Now, where are we going from here? What can we do about it?
And I think you're taking kind of a gloomy view of things.
I hope you're right.
I think there's a lot of exciting things going on in this country. Now, let me just give you an example.
In 30 seconds.
Okay, the response of the nation to the energy problems.
Right.
Back in my state, people are taking this as a personal challenge, and you'll find people that talk of how they've cut their fuel consumption, maybe not their bills, down by insulating. I got a wood stove in there, and I've got 2 wood stoves now, and I've got a coal stove here, and everybody is responding. And so I think that great days ahead, Gene, and I'm not a gloom at all. I think the best years are ahead.
Boy, what a great way to to end the show on an upbeat. It's been wonderful to have you here, and don't forget that this is my show, and you really should mention it in your closing.
Thank you very much, Gene, to be here with Conversation for Consumers.
You got the
Gene.
Title.
I'm delighted, and I appreciate your having me, Gene.
Thank you very much, Senator. This has been Conversation for Consumers with Senator John Chafee, Republican of Rhode Island. This program is a public service, and until next time, I'm Gene King.